This is God's word. Now, for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to marry. But since there is so much immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. Do not deprive each other except by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I say this as a concession, not as a command. I wish that all men were as I am. But each man has his own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. Now to the unmarried and the widows I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried as I am. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. To the married I give this command, not I, but the Lord. A wife must not separate from her husband. But if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And a husband must not divorce his wife. To the rest I say this, I, not the Lord. If any brother has a wife who's not a believer and she's willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who's not a believer and he's willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbeliever leaves, let him do so. A believing man or woman is not bound in such circumstances. God has called us to live in peace. How do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? Nevertheless, each one should retain the place in life that the Lord assigned to him and to which God has called him. Thank you. Please be seated. I don't think I have to tell you that relationships are in a kind of a confused state in our country, in our culture in general. And we in the church are part of our culture. We can't separate ourselves from it. We can try to deprogram, we can teach and immerse ourselves in the Bible, but we're a part of our culture. We're not going to get away from that. The definition of marriage is being debated in church and state and society. There's a lot of confusion, I think, for those who are single right now. Is marriage still something that I want? Is it worth it? Is it any good? Has it failed? Should I even bother? A lot of singles are agnostic about marriage in general, even if they're in a relationship. I know in this region, living together is just considered normal. Often it's an economic, or it's considered to be an economic necessity with a high cost of housing here. But it's considered, this is the way that you get to know somebody. This is the way that you determine whether you're compatible. And so we in the church, we're looking at the scriptures and trying to decide, what does the Bible say about marriage? We cannot help but absolutely swim against the tide of our culture. We couldn't be more opposite than the way our society's going. And so we respect, we revere, we defend biblical marriage. But one question that this passage helps us in, brings us up, is what do we have to say to single Christians? What do we have to say to those who are not married about the station in life that they're in right now? What do we have to say positive about it? And what does the Bible have to say positive about it? So I think this passage forces us to ask questions that maybe we wouldn't otherwise ask about singleness and marriage. So we're going to look at singleness first, then specific situations in marriage, and then we're going to look at what do they have in common? How do we look at these together in terms of being Christians in this world? So if you want to follow along in the outline, you're welcome to do that. The first thing I want to look at is a single-minded focus. Paul the Apostle was dealing with two opposing views in regard to marriage and relationships in Corinth. So you had two poles in society, and they were really reflected in the church too. On the left, you had the libertines. You had people that basically saw sexual expression as a right. This is something that it's just normal. You have to do it. It'll harm you physically if you don't express this urge. And we hear the same thing today. This is a very, very common idea. That was definitely true then. And even in the church, you had a lot of people that were chafing at the idea that marriage has to be confined, or that marriage is the only place where intimacy can be expressed. In Corinthian society, it was very common for men to have mistresses, sometimes multiple mistresses, and this bled over into the church. As people became Christians, they didn't just, boom, turn on a switch and automatically change all that behavior. They carried a lot of that into the church. So that's on the left. On the right, you had this other pole, people that some call the rigorous or the legalists or the ascetics. And these were people that basically, in reaction to the people on the other side, insisted that they really had come to the point where they believed that sex was sinful, that it was, it could not be redeemed. And so Christians should be celibate inside and outside of marriage. Now, obviously, not everybody believed that, or else they wouldn't have any children. But you definitely had, this was a strong viewpoint in the Corinthian church. And it's kind of hard to imagine that. But think about it in this way. In our society, we have large numbers of people that look at another gift of God, alcohol, and treat it as if it is itself intrinsically sinful, because you look at what all the carnage that is caused by alcoholism and the abuse of alcohol. Many Christians simply say, well, that can't be redeemed. We simply need to cut it out. And essentially, many people in the Corinthian church were looking at physical intimacy in the same way. So Paul's trying to navigate between these two opposing views, and he's taking heat from both sides. And we can see that in this passage. So I think we need to understand that. Paul's not just speaking in a vacuum here, not just talking about marriage and singleness in theory. He's in the middle of this battle where he's getting stuff thrown at him from both sides. So in verse 1, Paul's quoting a Corinthian saying from the ascetic side, from the legalist side. This is what people say. It is good for a man not to touch a woman. Then he goes on in verse 6 to clarify what is his position. And actually he says, you know what? I agree with this as far as my personal preference. I, not the Lord. He was single. He was very satisfied. And he wished a lot of other people to be single too, and to be free to serve the Lord just as he did. He thought it was a great thing. Now, I want to mention here that we're not 100% sure what Paul's marital status was. We are sure that he was single when he wrote this. We're not sure that he was always single. And one of the reasons is that we know that Paul studied under the rabbi Gamaliel. And so he was in training to be a rabbi. Rabbis almost exclusively were married. We don't know actually for sure that Paul finished his rabbinical training. The other thing is, in one passage, when he's defending himself before the Roman authorities, he mentions a vote or a position he took in the Sanhedrin. We're not sure that he was actually on the Sanhedrin or not, or if he was just referring to a decision they made and what his opinion was. But it was required by members of the Sanhedrin that they be married. So it's not crystal clear that Paul was single all of his life. The reason I say that is that if Paul was married at one time, probably one of two things happened. Either his wife died or his wife left him when he became a Christian. And if that's the case, it puts this passage in a different light. You realize, Paul's not just throwing out these options. He's not just talking to widows and people, Christians, whose non-Christian spouses have deserted them in an abstraction. It's very, very possible and reasonable that he actually went through this. And it just puts it in a little bit different light. It's a painful reality. It wasn't just a theory. So Paul's preference was clearly singleness. He saw both singleness and marriage as gifts from God. And Paul says to the unmarried, to the widowed, I recommend that you stay that way. You can serve God with great flexibility. But he says, if you are passionately in love with somebody, marry them. He says, if you're in love with them, marry them. That's God created the desire that you have. It's a good thing. Paul wants people to be honest about what they really want. Okay? Because God's will often, and usually I would say, comes through our desires. Martin Luther's a kind of a funny example of this. He was required to be celibate while he was a priest. Of course, he was in the Roman Catholic Church in the time of the Reformation. And after he was excommunicated by the Roman Catholic Church, he remained single, but he took great delight in setting up former nuns with former priests. He considered it sort of evangelism, I don't know, of some sort, but he got a big kick out of it. And there was this one group of nuns who escaped out of a convent in a, I believe it was a barrel of fish. Correct me on the details if need be. And he managed to marry all of them off except for one, this woman, Catherine von Bora. And he couldn't get rid of her. She seemed to scare men off. And so little by little, she actually convinced him that he no longer had the gift of celibacy, that he was called to marriage. She really persuaded him, kind of put the pressure on him. And it was a very unusual way for a relationship to start. But when you look at the story of Martin and Katie's relationship, as he called her, it was rich and full, and it was a beautiful relationship. And later he would say, you know, this woman, essentially, she saved me. She kept me sane in some of the dark nights of his soul. And yet the way it started was so, so different. Well, Paul's point that singleness is a good thing is really, really important for the church to think about today. We're in the Protestant church. The Catholic church generally has the perspective that singleness ought to be pursued by all, and in the church it's actually required for ministry. Oftentimes in the Protestant church we tend to react. We react in every sphere of life. But in the Protestant church, we do tend to react, I think, in this idea of singleness. We do tend to have a bias against it. To be single is not second best. We need to say that. There's often an unstated assumption that singles, you know, if you're single, you will get married, or you should get married. There are a lot of churches that will not hire a single pastor. And this is interesting because we need to remember that the perfect God-man, Jesus, was single. He never married. One of the greatest pastors of the 20th century that we revere, that had an incredible ministry and spoke with great authority on the issue of marriage over and over and over and wrote on it, John Stott, was single. Paul the Apostle was single. You have some of the greatest, and there's all, you know, thousands of pastors in between. People that spoke with great authority on the issue of marriage, and yet they were not married. It is not required for you to be married to be able to speak from the scriptures on marriage. Yes, it's helpful. There's certain aspects of helpful. But if a pastor has to experience every human condition to talk about it, well, goodness, then we've all failed. Because you can't possibly experience everything. Paul is making, he's a great contrast with the Roman Empire, because in that day, under Augustus, widows were often fined if they didn't remarry within 2 years. There was great pressure within the church, within society, for people to marry. And mainly this was for financial support. And that's where the church actually spoke very strongly within the culture. The church supported widows so that they would not feel forced to remarry. This was a big part of the ministry of the church. Tim Keller points out what he calls cross-gender enrichment. And this is the idea that a man and a woman complete each other. You know, we can look in the scripture and we can say, okay, that's a biblical principle. The man and the woman complete each other. But Keller points out something I think that's really important I hadn't thought about before. That he said, you know, that doesn't only happen in marriage. That can happen in a strong Christian community with men and women that are not married, that are not even romantically involved. Because what do we do in a healthy Christian community? What are we doing with each other? We're talking about how God is changing us, how God is shaping us, how he's growing us spiritually. And men and women can do that together. And in that sense, they are carrying out one, at least one aspect of that creation mandate, even outside of the bounds of marriage. I think it's a great point. We need to avoid idolizing marriage and family, lest people that are single enter for the wrong reasons, lest we set up this ideal that is really not attainable. If you're single, God has been good to you, just as you are. And if that is his will for the rest of your life, and if that is what you want, because generally your will and your want, his will and your want, are going to go together. God doesn't, he probably will not marry you against your will. He will not bring you dragging and screaming to the altar. And he will probably not keep you single against your will. They go together. But if that is his will and it is your will, you can be confident and joyful and fruitful in his service. We need to say that in the church. All right, the second thing I want to look at is a mutually serving team. And this brings in some issues of marriage. There's a Presbyterian pastor named Ray Contessa who once took a survey amongst his numbers of unchurched people. And he asked them this question. In one word, what does the church say about sex? So this is a Christian pastor asking non-Christian people, people outside the church, what they think the church says. What is one word, in one word, well, how would they describe what the church says about sex? You want to know the answer? Of course you do. The answer was no. Overwhelmingly, that was what unchurched people said that the church says about sex. No. Now, we can speculate about why people outside the church would have this perspective. The church encourages young singles to abstain from sexual activity outside of marriage. And maybe that carries over into marriage for a lot of people. Historically, also, though, many people in the church have looked at sexual activity as merely for procreation. This is something that we need to do to multiply and to fill the earth. And that's it. And maybe that's at best, and at worst, many people have looked at it as sinful in itself because it's so associated with sinful behavior that many people are like, well, forget it. We just can't redeem it. And I think Paul gives us a great snapshot of the Bible's attitude toward intimacy in marriage. And again, I want to remind you, he's fighting a war on two fronts. He's got the ascetic wing on the right. They reacted so strongly against the loose morals in Corinth that they're convinced that all sex is sinful, or that at least it should be discouraged, and married couples should focus on more spiritual things like praying and serving the poor. The other wing thought Paul was crazy because he didn't think that men should have five mistresses on the side in the church. And, you know, this is not that hard to imagine. In South Africa, you have this mentality in spades. Stan and Donna Arms, who had just retired from South Africa, were talking about how they were doing marriage conferences throughout the country. And they're trying to battle against this mentality where the pastors are telling men in the churches and men that they don't really talk about it with the people in the church, but with other pastors that they're training. You know, sort of a wink, wink, nod, nod thing. Well, everybody has a couple on the side. And, you know, when you go traveling, you got them in different cities. This is accepted in many arenas of the church in South Africa and in many other places. So the culture has affected the church, and this is what was happening in Corinth. So Paul's trying to deal with this. In verse 2, he uses the word have to refer to marital intimacy. Every husband... Since there's so much immorality, each man should have his own wife, each woman should have her own husband. That's what he's referring to in verse 2. People should be married, they want to be married, and they should enjoy one another. He's saying this is good. Physical intimacy is good. Well, in verse 3, he says it again, in another way. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and the wife to her husband. That's pretty self-explanatory. And then in verse 4, he says it a third time, in a different way. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. The husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. No, he's not talking about procreation here. He's not talking about multiplying. He's just talking about this is a gift that God says to enjoy. Now, in Corinthian society, including in the church, there was an infatuation with rights. Christians were taking each other to court. They were getting in quarrels in the church, and they were taking these quarrels to the secular courts to settle them. And it was a terrible, terrible testimony. But part of that was they just had this idea that I have a right to this and this and this. Well, Paul is basically saying here, all right, guys, you want to talk about rights? Men, you have no right over your body. Women, you have no right over your body. Your spouse has the right over your body. And this was a shocking statement because the men in Corinth, many of them figured they had a right not only to their wife's body or their wife, but they had a right to a few others too. And he's saying, no, you don't. These are mutual conjugal rights to the other. Husbands and wives owe a satisfying, dynamic, physical relationship to each other because they belong to each other. This is the Apostle Paul, people. This is what he's saying. And it's a radical concept in ancient society because women were basically considered servants. So what is Paul's view of the physical relationship in marriage? If it hasn't been apparent already, it's a gift from God. It's more than just what is required for procreation. This is a gift. It's meant to be enjoyed. It's ought to be enjoyed by the partners as an expression of their love for each other. So he does this in three verses, three different ways. Not until verse 5 does he get to an exception. And this is what I call selective symphonic abstinence, just because I wanted to sound fancy. If what he's saying in verse 5 is, if there is a pressing need, a tragedy, a crisis that demands really earnest, heartfelt prayer, and that you know, both of you are really aware of and feel passionately about, then you are in symphony about it. You're in agreement. Then you can abstain for a season to focus on that need. And I believe Paul chose this issue of prayer for a very particular reason. He wants the people on the right, he wants the ascetic types to know, prayer is not spiritual and sex carnal. I think he's picking this for a reason. He's saying both of these things are gifts from God. Don't try to spiritualize your relationship and think that you're better than this physical. He said, no, that's a part of your relationship. It's blessed by God. But sometimes one is set aside for the other, for a particular purpose. But note that he makes a point to say the norm must return. Why? So that Satan will not tempt you in regard to your self-control. Isn't that amazing? How much more wrong could the world be about the church's attitude toward physical intimacy in marriage? Paul says, no, this is right, this is normal, and it ought to be done as an enjoyment. And if you're not doing it, watch out, because Satan's going to tempt you. I mean, Paul knew that Satan targeted marriages and the physical relationship, and that's still true today. So don't spiritualize your disobedience to God's call to enjoy your spouse in the physical relationship. Serve one another through it. That's what Paul is saying. All right, the third thing I want you to see here is a God-glorifying calling. And this is in verse 10. Paul gets into marriage and divorce here a bit. And I think it's important for us to note what we noted about Matthew 19 last week. What is true of that passage is also true of this one. Neither Jesus in that passage nor Paul in this one were trying to say all that could be said about marriage. They're not giving a systematic theology of marriage. They're not giving a topical sermon on marriage. They're answering specific questions posed to them by specific people about specific situations. So we get the full biblical teaching on marriage by looking at all the passages that the Bible deals with on marriage. So we shouldn't try to pit one passage against another, saying, oh, well, you know, this one mentions remarriage, this one doesn't mention remarriage, so maybe we're not supposed to remarry. We need to be aware of that. We're looking at these two side by side. Jesus was not categorically ruling out remarriage in Matthew 19 when he's talking about divorce happening because of sexual immorality. I'm convinced Paul is not ruling it out here either. The fact that he doesn't mention it doesn't mean that it's not okay. We have to recognize the whole counsel of God on a particular issue is more than just one passage. Paul is addressing a culture where divorce was as rampantly out of control as the sexual sin that brought it about. That was the case in Corinth. Paul is not trying to contradict Jesus. His basic principle is the same as Jesus' basic principle, that marriage is God's idea, and he hates divorce. You know, he just says it very simply. If you're married, don't get divorced. That's what Jesus said. At the same time, he's not ignoring the fact that sin often brings about that state. The same thing that Jesus acknowledged. Paul actually affirms here when he's talking about somebody who becomes a Christian when their spouse is not a Christian. Many people in that day taught that if somebody became a Christian and their spouse is not a Christian, the fact that they're married together, they're interrelating, that the non-Christian would defile the Christian. And so they taught that, well, if you become a Christian, you're going to need to divorce your husband and your wife. Come out from among them. Be separate. And you can kind of see how they would do this. They're simply misapplying the Old Testament standards about separating from idolatry and from ungodliness. But this is what they were saying. Paul says, he goes to the complete opposite side and says, on the contrary, the unbelieving spouse and their children are sanctified through their believing spouse. He says, they are holy. Now, okay, what does this mean? We know that it can't mean that they become Christians automatically. That would contradict the scriptures about salvation being a gift of God's free grace. That's not true. But they are blessed to be in the home of a Christian. As Calvin put it, he said, it's not that the non-Christian spouse somehow taints the Christian spouse. It actually works the other way. There is a blessing and a benefit for a non-Christian spouse being in the home of a Christian. And so Paul says, don't destroy that. Don't try to split that up. Actually let God work. Now, in verse 15, Paul does introduce a situation where an unbelieving spouse deserts a Christian spouse. And Paul says, if that happens, if they go away, if they leave, let them go. He says, God has called us to live in peace, not to try to force an unwilling partner to stay against their will. But then notice after that, he says, how do you know whether you will change your spouse? You don't know how God will use your prayers, even after they leave, in changing their heart. What Paul is doing here, I think, is he's making a commentary on a gospel-centered life. If you're married to a non-Christian, you have no idea how God can work through you within that marriage. If you have been deserted by a non-Christian, you have no idea how God can use you and your prayers in their life and in their heart. Now, in verse 17, Paul sums up his message to both singles and married couples. He kind of brings things together and talks about what does it mean to be called? What are we called to be? He says, each one should retain the place in life that the Lord assigned to him and to which God has called him. In other words, what Paul's saying is, listen, God has either called you to be single or he's called you to be married, one or the other. He works through your desires. He's going to do this through your wants. But what Tim Keller says about this, again, that I like, is he says, if singles learn to rest in and rejoice in their marriage to Christ, they will be able to handle single life without a devastating sense of being unfulfilled and unformed. The same idolatry of marriage that is distorting their single lives will eventually distort their married lives if they find a partner. You see, what he's saying is, we can either on one side, we can idolize marriage and family and children. And we can look at these things that are gifts and we can try to find our happiness and our satisfaction through them. Guess what? It's not going to work. It's going to crash and burn every time. But on the other hand, we can idolize the independence of singleness and the freedom and the autonomy. And that's just as dangerous. At the same time, single people can often idolize marriage. If they're looking for marriage, they can have this sense that it will make me happy. And all of us that have been married can say, no. We can guarantee you that that is not the case. Marriage is not going to make you happy. You see, both idolizing marriage or idolizing independence are substituting God's for the satisfaction that we find in God alone, regardless of our relationship status. That's what brings these things together. We are both people who tend to manufacture false gods to bring us happiness. And it doesn't matter what status we're in. So the question is, how does this work? How do we rest in whatever status God has called us to right now, rather than looking for the grass on the other side of the fence? Well, I think the answer lies in our status as the church. Think about it. What is the church? It is the family of God. That's the way it's described throughout the scriptures. Regardless of our relationship status, we are the family of God. And God's family transcends all of our other families. It includes them and folds them in. If we are truly the family of God, then God calls us to live our lives before one another transparently and to point one another to the one who satisfies us, rather than all these other things, including our spouse or our independence. There's one author, Lauren Winter, who I think has a great suggestion. She suggests that we fight idolatry with community. She says, married people should invite singles into their homes and lives in such a way that they get a realistic picture, not an idealistic picture, of what marriage is all about. And this would help to fight idolatry on both sides. She says, one particular way that married people can do that is by displaying the real work of their marriages, not just the sweet light parts, but the hard embattled parts to the unmarried. In other words, spend time with people that are single. Let them see your marriage, not just when everything's going great. Let them see when you have disagreements. Now, this is hard. Why? Because we always want to put our best foot forward, including our married feet. We want people to see, you know, we want people to be attracted. But it's the same thing with being a testimony to people that are outside the church, right? We talk about, well, we need to be a good testimony to people that are not Christians. Well, do we really think that by only showing them the good parts of our lives that they're somehow going to be drawn to be Christians? No. They know we're frauds. I mean, they know we are messes. They know we're hiding it. It's much better to be simply be honest with people and let them see our flaws and our failings, because that actually points them to the gospel, which deals with those things. And so Lauren Winter is simply applying that to marriage and saying, let people see the warts in your marriage so that they can get a realistic picture and not be seeking an idol that will never satisfy them. I think what she's saying is that transparency is the pathway to true worship. And that principle carries through lots of different areas and relationships in the church. We don't have to pretend that our marriage is our source of happiness. We point to God, who is the source of our satisfaction, through the challenges in our marriage. And then singles, on the other hand, need to be transparent about how flimsy their independence is. If you're single, you need to stop pretending that you don't need anybody, because you do. Don't pretend to be self-sufficient when you're not. That's where the family of God, the body of Christ, really comes in, regardless of which state you're in. So no matter what state God has called you to, remember that He is good. And He is worthy of being worshipped with your life, because He will satisfy you and He will enable you to enjoy the state to which He has called you for His glory. Let's pray together. Father, we thank you.